name is Dan.
And my name is Michael.
And we are Dungeons & Dragons DMs who love to homebrew items, rules, creatures, and features for D&D. How you doing today, Michael?
I'm doing very well. How are you today, Dan?
I am so good. Despite the nature of today's prompt, for those of you listening here, maybe for the first time, each week we roll on our nice big table of community homebrew prompts, and both of us try and come up with something for D&D based on that prompt. And this week, what did we roll, Michael?
We rolled a series of feats based on the seven deadly sins.
Living in sin this week, I think.
For better or for worse.
How did you feel about this one?
So it was a mixed bag, right? The seven sins are vastly different for a reason, right? They're supposed to cover the full scope of sinful behavior, so they are all quite different by nature. I thought that this was difficult. I think both of us kind of talked about that when we made the monk feats, that we were not very well versed in the construction of feats in general. And I revisited that mindset a little bit this week, where I had no idea where to go with a few of them. And then others came to me very quickly and very easily. So I'm excited to see how both of us fared.
Yeah, this was a tricky one for me, because I started with something that I felt sort of medium about, and I think I ended with something that I kind of feel medium about.
Same.
For me, I landed on something that I felt tied them thematically together. But I wonder if maybe I gave myself a couple too many guardrails and things this time around.
Yeah. If you're listening for the first time, or if you haven't been paying attention to our podcast in the past, anytime I homebrew something, I give myself at least one rule to follow, so things don't go totally off the rails throughout a project. And I believe that Dan and I both have been inspired positively by each other, and we have grown to be more concise and streamlined homebrewers over the past 2 months as we've been working together. And sometimes that makes things much harder.
Yeah,
the
absolutely.
Self-imposed rules make things much harder. You know, pressure makes diamonds, Dan.
Hey, I will agree with you there for sure. Yeah, I think being under the gun like that, being forced to think in a different way is I'm never going to shy away from that. That's for sure. Even if I don't come out with something that I'm really, really stoked about, it's always going to be a good thing to challenge myself. That's for sure.
I think that's kind of the idea that we have followed generally, both of us, as we've done this, is kind of thinking outside of what the confines for the weekly prompt that we're doing would be labeled as, you know, subclasses that shirk the convention or feats that don't necessarily make sense as feats, but are there anyway.
Well, and I love how both of us have a couple of times now been able to really bring in mechanics that the game doesn't have in it innately, right? Like there are mechanics, there are ideas that we're still playing within the confines of the way the game is structured. We're still playing with metrics and tools that are there in the toolbox. It's just really fun to see us both being able to occasionally take some of those tools out and, you know, use a wrench as a hammer or something. You know, it's a different kind of way to approach a problem. I think for me so far this past couple of months have been, I think the most exciting moments is when you've introduced me to a way to think about a mechanical scaling mechanism or something else like that that I just like never would have come up with on my own.
I agree. I think that it's not something that I necessarily was seeking out before we started this. I'm always open to learn. I am very self-aware that I am not the perfect dungeon master or the perfect resource for homebrewing things for D&D. But that said, I don't know that I was expecting to glean as much as I have in such a short time from collaborating on similar prompts. I think that may be the thing, is we're doing the same things, and we're seeing now holes in our own processes or ways that we can improve, ways that not necessarily that we're lacking, but that we just are not 100% polished. And I think the other one might be. I said it a couple episodes ago. I think we're good foils for each other. It's a good symbiotic relationship where we work differently and we kind of end up back in the middle in opposite ways. And that's really great.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I didn't intend for this episode to turn into sort of a retrospective on our first couple of months of recording here, but
that's all right.
But it is really cool. I'm starting to definitely get a sense of how you build and how you approach, to the point where, like, I think if I take a prompt and if a thought occurs to me, like, how would Michael build this thing? How would Michael do this thing? I think I could land it pretty well. And
I think so, too.
That's close to the direction you would take, at least.
I think that's very cool. I agree. I feel the same way about your style. I have always been keen on throwing everything at the wall and hoping that all of it sticks, and then I just peel things off one by one until it becomes a concise project. And I am fully aware that that's not the best way to do things every single time. And the fact that you don't do that, and I have now kind of, now that I have absorbed some of your concise energy, I'm very appreciative.
Hey, you know, it's good. This is why it's good to collaborate. And this is for us. This is for the listeners as well, though. Like, you sitting in your home and, like, conceiving of all of these things, that is so cool. And I want to encourage you to keep doing that. But I think it's also so cool and important to share it and to be able to find someone else who you can collaborate with on those things, which I think is also why you and I draw so much inspiration from collaborating with our players on those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Because they are just as much a part of the creation process nowadays as I am. You know, I think I started and every single idea I had, I fully ideated and created on my own and then gave it to my players. And those things were cool. And I'm glad that I made them. And I think they were a great creative exercise for me. But I do think it changes the way I work when working with someone and when being able to play off of someone, get feedback, like see how their brain operates. It changes the game entirely.
Collaboration is infinitely important, and more so collaboration with another person or a group of people that will be honest but constructive. I think there's an innate fear of sharing homebrew, especially for D&D, because it's such a huge ecosystem, right? It's this massive game with, you know, thousands and thousands of players that are all experienced in their own ways. And you and I both know the second you put something out that's not mechanically balanced, or if it's formatted just a little bit incorrectly and you put it on Reddit, you will be eviscerated. You will have so many negative comments nitpicking all of your smallest flaws. One of the most refreshing things about this process is that you and I we know that the things we're putting out are imperfect. We're only taking, you know, 5 days to write these things, sometimes very complex, maybe too long, too complex things. But both of us are very generous in our candor. But also our respect for what the project is. You know, it is making a subclass in 5 days, which you shouldn't do. Like, that's not the recipe for a balanced subclass.
Yeah.
And this type of healthy collaboration is just incredible. So if you can find a person like that, or a group of people, or like your table operates that way, and you can be open and honest, but also respectful about the process of creation, that is just perfection. It's so rare, and hold on to that if you
yeah,
can.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right that if you just put this stuff out into the world, out into the internet, like, it's hard to get good feedback. I've tried it a number of times. I'm sure you have as well. I'm sure a ton of our listeners have tried making something. You put it out into the world, and the only comments or responses you get are to correct minor flaws, tell you it's wildly unbalanced, but give you no sense of like what you can do to fix it.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. What's really special about this, and what I think is part of the goal of this podcast, is to show that like behind that one page or two pages of content that gets put up on the internet, there is a whole process. There's a thought process. There is who knows how many hours like trying to figure out the formatting. There is a lot of research. There's a lot of headache. There's a lot of trial and error that goes into it. That's all part of the process. Yeah. And it's all in service of trying to approach a problem or approach an idea. And sometimes you struggle with that. Sometimes you run into roadblocks. You know, both of us have run into a number of huge stumbling blocks this that have had us come up with something that maybe, you know, has the idea of something good, but like isn't quite there yet. But I think us being very honest about the fact that like, we're not necessarily pleased with this thing. We like the bones of it. We like X, Y, and Z about it. And this is the process we went through to get there. I hope it's really instructive for people to hear that process and to engage with it and say like, oh yeah, like it takes a lot of time and a lot of people in a lot of cases to come up with a new subclass that actually is like publish ready, you know? That's not going to happen the first time you share something on the internet. And still being willing to try it, still being willing to ask for feedback, implement that feedback, it's all part of a larger process. I'm not entirely sure what I'm trying to say here, but I do feel like there is something to this where we're pulling back the curtain on some of these processes.
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for making anything in a short amount of time, just how unpredictable the result can be. Sometimes you hear, you know, even, you know, like famous musicians, they'll go on talk shows or podcasts or whatever, and they're like, oh yeah, this hit song that's played on the radio 10 million times, I wrote it in one evening, right? I was just in the bath and I got a spark of inspiration and I wrote this huge song in 20 minutes, and I went and I recorded it, and that's the thing that you're hearing on the radio. But then you ask the same musician, like, what's the song that you're most passionate about? What's the song that you put the most thought into? And it's always like the deepest cut B-side song that they took like 7 years to write because it just couldn't come out of their body. I feel like homebrew is the same way, where there sometimes you just get big hitting things that will work at a surface level that you can write in 5 minutes and throw into your games, and other things really take time, but more importantly, they take space. You write them down, you get your ideas out there, which is the hardest part, by the way, is starting something and getting something fully realized on paper. Not balanced, not perfect, but fully on paper, and then you just take like 5 months and don't look at it. You come back and you now have fresh eyes. You're looking at your own work as a stranger, and you can now see all the holes, right? You can see all the things that don't necessarily look good. They don't feel like a mechanic that would operate well. There's the sheen of newness, a recency bias, I guess you could call it, when you're first starting out. It's like, oh yeah, this is going to be the sickest subclass ever. This is going to be so awesome. And you come back a month later and you're like, I don't know what I was thinking there. where was this idea going?
Yeah, no, that all is so true. And I do think like shedding some light on that process, shedding some light on all of what it takes, and acknowledging that these things take time, they take energy, and they take, you know, lots of feedback, lots of drafts, lots of working through problems, trying to iron out things, you know.
Yeah.
I'd be surprised if anyone's first draft of any item or anything like that is what makes it into the book at the end of the day, you know?
Right. Except for the Battle Rager Barbarian. Whoever wrote that abomination, that was the first draft, and they said, yeah, just ship it out. Just ship it out. We'll put it in a book.
Oh, man. Never letting it go. Never, ever letting it go.
The hatred I have for that subclass is unreal and unhealthy. I don't like it at all.
Well, anyway, now that we've hit on how much you hate Battle Rager again.
Gosh, it's awful.
But, shall we get to the task at hand, though?
I think so. Yeah. I think it's high time to get to some Deadly Sin feats.
Well, let me share with you first my feats that I honestly didn't have time to do, like, a full excellent formatting on these. It's just, it's pretty bare bones. But let me tell you about my process here. So the first stage of this was, okay, what are the seven deadly sins, and how can I start to think about them in a mechanical sense? Some of them are very easy. Some of them, like, sort of already play into existing mechanics. I'm thinking about Wrath and Rage play well together, of course. But there are some other ones that have fewer close ties. So immediately I was like, well, I'm not just going to go for the easy options for any of these. Instead, I want to give myself a couple of regulations for these. One is that I want them to be feats, but I also want it to be the kind of thing where this could be a feat that you don't necessarily take when you reach a level that grants you a feat or something like that, but the kind of thing that perhaps at a DM's discretion, based on the way you play your character or whatever else it is, maybe you get this feat automatically because your character is taking on something that is, it's not exactly an eldritch sort of patron-packed sort of thing, but it has, like, the ideas of you are succumbing to the temptation of this vice. So, because of that, I also wanted each one to have a downside. It should grant some benefit, but it should also have a downside, as these are sins. These are, obviously, as they call them, the deadly sins. These are the mortal sins. These are the ones that are chief among them, or whatever. So they all had to have a downside. They all had to, obviously, fall in line with the ideas they were trying to achieve, although I did sort of expand on them into sort of the larger spirit of the sin in some cases. And then I gave myself the additional guidance that I wanted them all to have thematic similarity. Okay. So I didn't want to do a thing where, like, the feats for lust focused on charm effects and status effects and that sort of thing, while the feat for a different thing was specifically damage based, like Wrath. I didn't want to have them feel like they were divorced from each other. I didn't want to have some feel like utility and some feel like combat features. So I made seven feats that all affect D20 rolls and levels of bonuses.
Checks,
and
rolls, and saves.
Nice. Checks, rolls, and saves. Please open, if you would, the mortal sins. These are seven deadly feats, or the seven mortal sins. And I'll just read you my little preamble.
Please, go ahead.
Life itself is a dreadful risk, a roll of the dice against the cruel hand of fate. It is only fair to imagine, then, that there are individuals who would seek to turn that fate in their favor, even if it comes at a great cost. Perhaps you yourself are one of these souls, succumbing to the temptation of mortal sins to gain the slightest edge in a callous and unfavorable world. When you gain a feat of your choice, or perhaps through some other means at your DM's discretion, you can take on one of the following mortal sins for good and ill. So, we begin with the sin of arrogance. When you roll a 20 on the d20 for an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw, you gain 1d6 temporary hit points, and you gain advantage on the next d20 roll of the same type that you make. However, When you roll a 1 on the d20 for an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw, you take 1d6 points of psychic damage, which cannot reduce your hit points below 1. So your crits give you a little bit of an additional help, and your crit fails, however, also deal you a little bit of psychic damage. Then we have the Sin of Avarice. When a creature within 15 feet of you makes an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw that results in a 1 or a 20 on the d20, you are compelled to use your reaction, if it is available, to force that creature to reroll and use the second result. The result of the next ability check, attack roll, or saving throw you make before your next long rest, then, is treated as the result you cancel with this reaction. So other people's crits become yours. You hoard both the positive and the negative crits around you. Then we have the Sin of Desire. Whenever you fail an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw, you can grant yourself advantage on the next d20 roll of the same type you make. However, if you fail on the next roll of the same type, you gain disadvantage on all ability checks, attack rolls, and saving throws you make for 1 minute and cannot use this feature again until you complete a short or long rest. So it's this like longing for getting yourself closer to greatness, but that comes at a cost of potentially...
That is really cool. That's like into like the psychology of like gambler's brain, where you just keep giving yourself advantage until you fail, and then you fail big. That's great.
Yeah, that's sort of the intention behind it. The idea was that when I was looking through a lot of information about the seven deadly sins, I wanted to expand them beyond sort of the most sort of rote example of them. You know, I think we think of lust, and obviously our brains always go to
sins of the flesh.
Sins of the exactly. You know, your brain goes to, I think, the movie Seven and like sort of gruesome, the most gruesome versions of any of these things. But looking through them, you know, there's a lot more to it than that. There's this like longing that draws you towards sin that really is sort of at the heart of lust. And it is general desire. It is general longing. It is the kinds of things that are, you know, your desires for whatever it might be are pulling you to act badly in service of those desires. That's kind of the whole thing of it. So I was like, let's just play on that instead. And similarly with the following feats, the Sin of Excess, which is based around gluttony. It's not based around food or anything like that, but it is based around you taking on too much. More than you need, more than you deserve, more than is healthy. So you have a pool of bolstering points equal to your character level that replenishes when you take a long rest. When you make an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw, but before you know the result, you can expend points from this pool to grant yourself a bonus to the roll equal to the number of points you expend. If you succeed on the roll, you then take psychic damage equal to the difference in your result and the DC. So you get a little bit of psychic damage if you go in excess. You can allow yourself to succeed. You could succeed wildly in certain cases, right? If you are a 14th level and you expend all 14 points on a check that you already rolled an 18 on just to make sure that you got it, that might be great. But also then you're going to pay the price for that excess.
That's great. What a cool mechanic.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you are liking these a lot because I'm very lukewarm on
We talked about subclasses a little bit earlier. My favorite fighter subclass is the samurai, and it is very basic, right? It's rife with simplicity, and these give me the same vibe, right? They're very straightforward, they're very simple, but they give you just the right amount of risk to be enticing. And maybe that is just apropos of being the week where we talk about deadly sins. But I think these are great. They have beauty in their simplicity. Fantastic.
I'm very glad to hear that you think that way. That makes me feel a lot better. So next we have the Sin of Fury. When you make an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw, you can choose to make the roll with advantage. If either die rolls a 1, however, you must treat the roll as a critical failure. This one and the next one have a limited use. Once you've used this feature a number of times equal to half your character level, you cannot use it again until you complete a long rest. And then the Sin of Idleness is exactly the opposite. So when you make an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw, you can choose to make the roll with disadvantage. But if either die rolls a 20, you can treat this roll as a critical success. Once you've used this feature a number of times equal to half your character level, you may not use it again until you complete a long rest. So they're sort of the opposites of each other. Idleness is inaction, allowing you to take some disadvantage, but if you happen to succeed greatly, you are rewarded. Whereas Fury is more action without necessarily thinking of the consequences at all times. And then finally, we have the Sin of Jealousy, which is when another creature within 15 feet of you rolls a 1 on the d20 for an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw, you gain 1d6 temporary hit points and advantage on the next d20 roll of the same type you make in the next minute. However, when another creature within 15 feet of you rolls a 20 on the d20 for an ability check, attack roll, or saving throw, you take 1d6 points of psychic damage. This damage cannot reduce your hit points below 1. So this is sort of the opposite of arrogance in this case. Most of these have sort of a point and a counterpoint. Yeah. Jealousy being the opposite of arrogance, your pride rewards you but can also get in your way. And in the case of jealousy, your envy of those around you,
to your detriment, yeah,
and their success ends up harming you. Is I to love your that. Detriment, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. So I did enjoy making the sort of like counterpoint ones, and I think in general they work fairly well. Yeah. I don't know. I think for me, the thing that I'm still not sure if I like. It's just how they don't all feel like they are all of a piece. And they don't all feel like they would work well in-game. Some of them are limited in how many times they can be used. Some of them aren't. But I just had a tough time figuring out how to iron out those kinks. And I think this is a great example of what we were talking about earlier in that, like, I have the bones of some ideas there, but I think I'm overthinking it in this way or that way.
Come back to it in a month.
Yeah, exactly. This is the kind of thing that I probably won't look at this after this episode for a while. And maybe I'll come back to it and be like, actually, I do like the concepts here and here and here. And maybe I'll just adjust them or change something up there. But yeah, I do like a couple of them. I like the interplay between idleness and fury, of arrogance and jealousy. I like the concept of the Sin of Avarice, of greed, allowing everyone else's crits to be yours.
That's very cool.
Although I don't know if it works for every role, because you're compelled to use your reactions, so it pulls it out of combat and means that, like, it literally anytime anyone makes a roll, even in a utility, even in, you have to kind of be stealing crits all the time, which is like, is that as fun as only doing it in combat? But like, if that's only in combat, then everything else kind of
does
falls
hijack
apart.
Agency a little bit. Yeah,
but then again, and this is what I was talking about and giving myself too many rules, I think I was really stuck on like, well, if that one is something that only functions in combat, they should all just be things that function in combat, but some of them don't make sense for that in the same way that they do otherwise. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a tough balance, especially in a game that's combat centric by necessity. It's very, very hard to skip moments in combat, and it's incredibly easy to skip through social encounters. It's incredibly easy, even more so, to skip through long bits of exploration and travel. So when you have a feat that really could come in handy in a social situation or in a role play situation, it inherently is out of balance with a combat feat, right? Because the combat feat is going to get more time under the microscope. Here's what I like, though. I really like how concise all of them are. I like how easy they all are to understand. I think these are, like you said, the perfect type of feat for a DM to just hand out based on a character choice or a moment of circumstance. If a character falls prey to one of these sins, this is the perfect reward for that player, especially if they are a player or a PC that is an agent of chaos. These are really great things mechanically to enhance a chaotic style of play, which I tend to gravitate towards. I would definitely enjoy receiving a feat like this. I don't know that I would select one, you know? So I think they definitely make sense as a DM handout, and they work really well in that arena.
Yeah, I think that is really where the intention came through on, mm-hmm. on these. Is that I do play with a bunch of players who are of that persuasion, who are always the first ones in line to give their player or to give their character some sort of stumbling block, some sort of disadvantage in order to further some part of their narrative, some part of the things that they are excited about playing out in roleplay or in combat or whatever it is. I play with so many of those players, and I love them to death. It's crazy.
Great. It's a great way to play.
Crazy people. It's my favorite. I love it so much. Players who will just like do something that is decidedly against their best interest as a character.
Yeah.
But they commit to it because it is like the correct choice to push something else forward. And it's a unique version of it's what my character would do. Right. It's not it's what my character would do in an antagonistic like party clash sort of way. It's what my character would do in order to like create a dramatic moment that everyone is bought in
for the benefit of the game, for the benefit of the story.
Yeah. That's when it's good.
I love that.
Yeah. So anyway, I appreciate your kind words. I really I can see what you're saying. Now and I do feel quite a bit better after hearing that that take on it. On what their strengths are, and I think that's the kind of thing that I can take and maybe try and play up those strengths a little bit more, maybe mm-hmm. really lean into the idea that these aren't feats that you choose, these are feats that are given to you, and allow that to inform the way they're written as
I have a couple of those on my list that I was not thinking about that way, and now I feel better about those ones if they were just handed out, which we'll see in a moment. But this is good to collaborate. You can make other people feel better about their creations, and you can also feel better about your own creations.
It is. It's great. Well, there's no time like the present, Michael. Let me see your feats.
Great.
I want to
know. Please open up my 7 sinful feats. Once you open it up, it is sinful with a question mark in parentheses.
Okay.
My rule this week was to not look into the 7 deadly sins at all. Take them at face value and kind of turn everything on its head to see what type of misdirection a player can achieve taking a feat that's labeled greed and just not having anything to do with the sin whatsoever.
I am fascinated by that approach, because it sounds like you were like, I'm not gonna look at it at all, and I'm like, I'm gonna do a deep Wikipedia dive. I'm gonna find out all of the like different minutiae. What's the history of each of these? Were they all always called the things that they were? Spoiler alert, they weren't. Great that both of us
truly
just, like,
as you were reading,
completely different
as you were reading yours. The entire time I was thinking, oh my gosh, this is the most different our creations have been out of 2 months.
It.
This
That's
is
great.
This is the furthest away they've been, and I couldn't be happier. I love
excellent.
When they're so similar, just by divine. But I also really enjoy when things are so dissimilar that we can really be surprised and delighted by each other's creations. So I too have an introduction. Again, this is kind of camp, kind of over the top, in the sense that I view this as like a block watchman reading this off as a warning to take heed of to just like city passerby. Sin is everywhere these days. Around any given corner, the abhorrent slime of humanity will expose itself to you and your unfortunate and naked gaze. These putrid sinners walk about the world, basking in shadow, reveling in evil, and dispensing the toxic stench of their misdeeds out to all who dare venture near. It is advised that you stay clear of the path these maniacal scoundrels forge. However, if avoidance is not possible and you must blend in with the corruption, for your own personal safety, of course, the following list of features may help you. These feats are so unequivocally, irreparably, and universally soaked with sin, you will have no issue convincing a true criminal that you belong in their devilish place of darkness.
I love it. I also have a feeling that we are gonna play around with that idea of these being quote unquote soaked in sin.
I went an incredibly silly route this week. I think all of them are they take the name of the sin and the general vibe, and that's all that they take. It's like LaCroix of sin. Just a tiny little bit.
Just the essence.
So we're going to start with the just the essence. Yeah. Yeah. You're sitting in a house and the sin is like two rooms over for you.
Sin essence.
Yeah. Sin adjacent. These are.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to start with envy. Your body has begun to turn green and can color match to your surroundings, provided that they are also green. When standing in front of anything that is green, you are proficient in the dexterity stealth skill and can take the hide action as a bonus action. If you take this feat a second time, you can take it up to three times. Your proficiency bonus is tripled for all checks made under the above conditions. Again, that is standing in front of something that is green. If you take this feat a third time, you can become invisible as a free action when standing in front of anything that is green, and you can't be seen even by creatures possessing a special sense. So it all is based on your physical placement, which doesn't appear in the game nearly enough. Color-specific.
This is great. That's very fun. Very silly.
So that obviously is a play on green
indeed,
with
indeed.
Envy.
Very good. Very
green
good.
With envy. Next, we move on to gluttony. This is derivative of a glutton for punishment.
Mm-hmm.
You have grown accustomed to sustaining damage in battle, and you can use your resilience to protect others. You increase your dexterity score by 1 to a maximum of 20. Additionally, you have a number of gluttony points equal to your proficiency bonus. Whenever a creature within your melee range is hit by a spell or weapon attack that targets only them, you can use your reaction to spend 1 point and step in front of them, taking the punishment instead. You regain your expended gluttony points when you finish a long rest. So you can just take the hit instead of your friends.
Yeah.
Or your enemies. If you. Next up is greed. This is where I start to get a little bit more experimental with the feats here. You can now use your collected wealth to attack your foes with precision. You gain a new attack option that you can use, throwing gold and gemstones as an attack. The range, damage die, and damage type of the attack is determined by the type of treasure you throw, as established on the treasure attack table below. So if you throw gold pieces, I just kind of lumped all of the, you know, coinage together. So silver, copper, all of those, same thing. You can throw it to a range of 60 feet. It deals slashing damage. To the tune of 2d6 plus your dex modifier. Small gems, which have a value of 1 to 300 gold pieces. You can throw those 40 feet, dealing piercing damage for 3d6 plus your dex. Or a large gemstone, which is 301 gold pieces and up. You can throw those 20 feet for bludgeoning damage to the tune of 4d6 plus your dex modifier. If a piece of treasure is used for this attack option, it counts as ammunition and a projectile for the purpose of any ability the target may have to catch or deflect it. All treasure used for ammunition is removed from your inventory as you take the attack and can be picked up by any creature from its point of landing.
Wow.
So essentially, you can be the money-grubbing chaos goblin that everybody likes to be in D&D, but when we run into the problem of having too much money and nothing to spend it on, you can just throw it at your enemies instead.
I love this one especially. Well, two things. One, I think it should be limited to gold pieces, not silver or copper, because then you could just have like a little Gatling gun of copper pieces. If it's gold pieces, it's still you're giving up something, right? You're giving up something that like actually has some value.
Yeah.
But I love this as like an actual. I'm imagining an actual goblin character who maybe is a merchant or like a treasure hunter or something like that, but has no sense of the like monetary value of treasure.
Yeah.
And simply is like, ah, more ammunition.
Right.
Yes.
Big rocks.
And everybody else is like, no, that's like valuable. And he's like,
don't
yeah,
do that.
It does a lot of damage. It's
46,
great.
Dude.
Look how cool it is when I throw this like big gem that's worth over 300 gold. Woo. That hit so hard.
Yeah. Can you believe
no,
it?
Wait. Amazing. That would be absolutely 100% the character I would play with this. One who is completely and utterly
ignorant yeah.
to the fact that money has value.
As I was reading this, I thought one of the things that stuck out to me as the most comical is that one gold piece does 2d6 damage, and like up to 300 gold pieces does 3d6 plus your dex. So you could just shill out gold piece after gold piece and like be fine. But just the option of having the bulkier things, if you need to do 46 in one hit, like you don't have many turns to sink into a combat, you just have to use your giant gems that your foe could get hit with. And they're like, okay, great. 700 gold pieces worth of sapphire. Thanks.
Yeah. Or if all your money
is
in gems,
I'll take that hit. Right.
We're on the gem economy here.
Yeah. I don't deal in gold pieces. Yeah. I'm more of a stock and bond kind of guy. I deal just in gemstones.
Oh, that's so good.
Next up, I have lust. This is the most outlandish one.
Okay.
And I think this functions a lot better under the pretense that you set with your list, where this could be something that the DM just decides you have. I don't know anybody that would actually take this. But if you do, I love you and I want you to play at my table. Another creature has developed a strange and fervent infatuation with you. The identity of the creature and the nature of the infatuation can be decided upon in whichever way you and your game master choose, but the creature should not intend to do you harm. The infatuated creature will actively pursue you at all costs, stopping only when the two of you have met in-game. From there, you can choose one of the following options. You can accept, so you choose to allow the creature to accompany you. They will never attack you or your allies and will actively fight in tandem with you in all situations. You can choose to ignore them, so you choose to remove yourself from the situation, causing the creature to resume their search for you, or you can disown. You choose to reject the creature's advances, causing them to turn on you. They will not outright attack you, but will attempt to impede your adventuring. For example, foil future plans, give away your location. If the infatuated creature decides to stop pursuing you or outright dies, another creature is chosen either at random or by your game master to fill their shoes. So you're always being pursued by another creature forever.
It follows. But like a little less terrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very, very silly.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it a lot. I also like the open-ended nature of what this creature can be.
Yeah.
It could be
It could anything. Be anybody. It could be your long-lost son trying to find you and rekindle a father-son bond.
Could be.
It doesn't have to be it doesn't have to be romantic in nature. It could be
a black pudding that really likes you.
Yeah. It could be whatever you want, or it could be something that you have no idea and your game master is just waiting to reveal it to you. It's an instant story beat for your character. And that's how I looked at it. Certainly not mechanically feasible at all, other than the fact that you have an ally if you choose to accept them. But really, it's just for social and story purposes.
Yeah.
Almost 100%. Moving on to the next one, we have Pride. The prerequisite for this feat is you have to be a Leonin. So you have to be a lion. You've come to realize, whether actually true or through the consequence of collective social gossip, that you are the heir to a far-off throne. Your charisma score increases by 1 to a maximum of 20, and you have advantage on all charisma, persuasion, and intimidation skill checks. Additionally, as long as your charisma score is higher than their intelligence score and you do not harm them, no beast will take any aggressive action towards you.
Wow.
So this is Simba coming back to Pride Rock.
Yep, yep. Mm-hmm.
Simple but fun.
Leonin is an incredibly fun and silly prerequisite for this feat.
Right. To my knowledge, nothing else requires you to be a Leonin, so this is the first one.
I gotta say, I love how each of these is very much just like, what's the word? And the yep. first, like, the first thing that comes to your brain in word association is the thing that was the inspiration for this. It's just like,
yeah.
Gluttony, glutton for punishment. Envy, green mm-hmm. with envy. Pride of lions. Okay.
I really tried very hard to not overthink anything, and I think I did well to follow that, except for greed. I had a really hard time with greed and lust. Greed and lust were difficult.
Yeah,
they were my last two. Next up, sloth. You have befriended a timid but kindly sloth spirit. See its in-game statistics and the accompanying sloth companion stat block, which uses your proficiency bonus in several places. The sloth can be summoned as a bonus action and follows you, obeying your commands to the best of its ability. In battle, it shares your initiative count and takes its turn immediately after yours. If the sloth is reduced to 0 hit points, it vanishes and cannot be summoned again for 24 hours. Then we move into the sloth companion stat block, which I included just below that. Its only action that it can take is a hug. The sloth prompts a strength saving throw from the target within 5 feet, contested by an athletics check from the sloth. On a failure, the target is hugged tightly by the sloth, reducing its speed by 5 times your proficiency bonus. So up to 30. So at level 20, this sloth can just like lock creatures down. The target can remake the saving throw, still contested by the sloth, at the end of each of its turns. The sloth can't take any other actions and gains the restrained condition while hugging, but can release the hug at any time as a free action.
Just a little homie.
Yeah.
It's great.
He's just following you along, killing people with kindness. Sometimes literally, maybe.
This is a great little fae sloth companion. Just following you around.
Yeah.
Slow guy. Likes to climb trees. Likes to give big hugs.
Slow guy. Yeah. Okay. Maybe he just climbs on your back, and you probably have to carry. He's small, so you'll have to carry him most of the time.
It's
but
great.
Worth it for
it's
the hugs.
Perfect reading of sloth, if you ask me.
yeah. Just exactly what they meant when they wrote The Sin of Sloth.
Yeah.
The last is Wrath, which I interpreted as Wrath of the Gods. You have garnered the attention of a higher power. A god, a titan, an otherworldly entity, or some other being of immense power has granted you limited control of its wrath. When you take this feat, you can choose one of the following options and can change to a different option anytime you gain a level. When you hit a target with a melee or ranged attack, you can imbue the attack with an additional effect depending on the benefit that you chose. So there are many choices below this. Depending on the god that you choose, essentially the format for all of them is the same. The target takes an extra d6 of damage, and the damage is different based on the choice that you make. For instance, we have the Wrath of the Frost Maiden. The target takes an extra d6 cold damage and is restrained until the end of their next turn. So it doesn't go a full round. Just a streamlined version of some other feats that already exist in the game with options that are similar to these, just an expedited system for that.
Yeah.
8 options. I feel like this is also something that if anyone would ever choose to use this, a DM could add options of their own or kind of move them around based on what they wanted to do with their players.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I do think the gluttony and wrath are the ones that, to me, just like looking at them, feel the most like, okay, that's a feat that I think somebody would actually take. That's a feat that like has a slightly more serious mechanical value, I suppose. Like envy is somewhat mechanically valuable as
mechanical value,
as is sloth, but like. The thing that those are, I think, best at, those three, are the tone and, like...
Yes, yes.
Landing the plane in terms of, like, yeah, we've taken the idea here, and we're just going in a different direction and doing a very different thing in a way that is very fun, and that's why you would take any of those on.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, lust and pride almost feel like ones that, yeah, would have to be granted from an outside source. Even wrath, maybe to a degree, but...
Yeah.
I really do enjoy that you tried to go a left turn away from the basic concept of each of these and into a slightly different direction, which I very much appreciate. I think it's really quite funny.
Wildly different than yours.
Yeah, yeah. Very much so. Very much so. Which, hey, I love that. I'm glad that we came up with a couple of different avenues here to take. And just points out to me that, like, not everything has to be optimized in order for it to be useful or fun or good, right? Like, envy is not an optimal feat, but it is incredibly fun to think about, like, what that would bring up in a game at a table, you know?
Right. What are the implications of you physically turning green?
And I think I'm going to lean more into that in the future as we go on. You know, I think we hit a little bit of stupid and silly in the fighters block as well. But honestly, I could have gone harder into the fighters block for stupid and silly. And I'm going to take some inspiration from this, I think, and lean more into the stupid and silly on occasion.
It's a great place to be, so, man. It's so good.
It sounds fun. It's good. I like it a lot. Great stuff. Great stuff all around. I think it's very good.
Thank you. Well, Dan, both of these were wildly different. I really enjoyed seeing yours and kind of dissecting how we both interpreted Seven Deadly Sins. Would you like to roll for our next prompt?
Yes. Yes, I would like to roll for our next prompt. If any of our listeners have a prompt or an idea for something, or maybe a totally different idea for the Seven Deadly Sins feats... that we didn't talk about or that occurred to you during our discussion, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach out to us via email at collegeofcreationpod@gmail.com. Or, hey, you can always jump on our Patreon. You can see the first draft versions of these creations that we've been making there. Read through them all, take them, use them in your games, if they're even usable. You can shoot us a message there as well and send us some prompts. We would absolutely love to hear from you if you've got ideas.
Or you could find either of us on TikTok. I am there at Michael_Barlos, and Dan is on TikTok at SirDrK. Please drop us a message, comment on one of our posts. We'd love to talk to you about homebrewing, about prompts for the future, or whatever you'd like to talk about D&D related.
So let me throw this die through my tower here. We'll see what we roll for. It is a 16.
A 16 today is a feat for marshals that draws aggro or makes enemies more likely to attack them, like taunting, but with a bonus. That is from Tarrant on TikTok.
So some sort of feat.
Like goading attack.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
Feat for marshals that goads enemies into attacking them.
Yeah, I think the tricky part about this one is going to be not stepping on the toes of any existing features and making something that feels unique. I think there are ways to do it.
Absolutely.
And maybe one that more effectively achieves the intended goal.
Got to find the creative avenue around that.
We'll see what the both of us come up with on that one next time. I'll give you about a week to think about this. And then we will present once more. I've been going at it for 2 months now, and hopefully many, many more to come. Michael, you have something to say to the people before we say goodbye?
Dan, you know I always have something to say to the people. before we say goodbye. Today's is a little bit more serious, in contrast to my Seven Deadly Sins feats that were very silly. Today I'd like to talk directly to Dungeon Masters. It is incredibly important that you honor your players' boundaries and thresholds. And there's a distinction between them, right? The boundary is the thing that your players say they don't want to have happen to them or happen to their player character in your game. And the threshold is how close they are comfortable to you getting to that boundary without it becoming uncomfortable. I cannot stress enough how important it is for the maintenance of a healthy and open table to respect players' boundaries and thresholds. It is imperative that you do this. I hope that if you're not having consistent discussions about boundaries, that becomes part of your weekly routine or however long or however consistently you play. So please do that. Always respect everybody's boundaries at your table. It will make the game much more fun and enjoyable for everyone involved.
Absolutely. I will agree with that 100%. Trust at the table is so huge. So huge. Thank you, Michael.
Of course. And thank you, Dan, for another great episode.
You as well, Michael. We'll see you all next week. Take care of yourselves.
Bye. Goodbye. Hey everyone, it's Michael. Thanks for listening to this episode of the College of Creation. If you want to see our creations from this episode and our past episodes, you can find those for free on our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/collegeofcreationpod. And if you decide to become a patron, you'll also automatically get access to any revised versions of the things we've created, plus our patron Discord, and bonus chats with Dan and myself. You can send any of your own homebrew prompts or questions to collegeofcreationpod@gmail.com, and our music is by Fuserwolf. You can check out his tunes on Bandcamp and Spotify. As always, thank you so much for listening.